All right. Any event, we had a bunch of discussion yesterday. Let me get my power cord in. Bunch of discussion yesterday about what we meant by computational morphodynamics. But the reason we're gathered here for the next few weeks is because we want to invent a new field. And we're not quite sure what it is yet, but I'm going to give you my take on it this morning of what I think we need to do to really understand how plants and animals develop. I'm a developmental biologist, so I really want to understand how organisms go from a fertilized egg to something as complicated as a human being. And there's a series of problems implicit in that that developmental biologists have not confronted honestly, even though the field of developmental biology is 250 or 300 years old by now, that people have been looking at embryos develop. And the problem could be expressed in a couple of ways, and I'll do it very briefly. The first way is this, that we have genome sequences now. This isn't the thing that the people 250 years ago were worried about, but it is now. And so we know what the coding properties of the genome are, and therefore have a reasonable idea of what the list of proteins are and functional RNAs are that are made in the genome. And then we know what a fully developed human being looks like with 10 fingers and 10 toes and 2 eyes and a brain with 5 times 10 to the 12th cells in it, each of which are connected to 10 to the 4th other cells. How do you get from the list of parts to the human being? The thing people have been a little dishonest about is that they've not confronted the complexity of the problem. And the complexity is not in the genome. The Arabidopsis genome, or the human genome, has 20-something thousand genes in it. It's not much. But it's in the complexity of the organism, that a human being has maybe 5 times 10 to the 14th cells of several times 10 to the 3rd or more different types. Nobody really knows how to define a cell type. And they all end up in the organism in the right places, forming by a process that takes about 9 months, and then you're born. After that, not much happens except that you get old. And so that, we've got maybe in a year, you're going from a fertilized single cell to something with maybe 10 to the 14th cells that can see and hear and do all this stuff and think at the level that babies think, and it gets better. And so how in the world do you do something like that? It's a problem whose complexity is far beyond anything that engineers have ever confronted or even thought about. And as an example to that, I'll tell a story I've often told about a conversation I had with one of my colleagues who's an engineer at Caltech named John Doyle. And Doyle at the time, he's worked on many things, but at the time he was working on the complexity of instructions in computer-aided design programs at Boeing. And he was working with them on the 777 aircraft. And he told me that a 777 had about 100,000 assemblies in it, by which he meant something Boeing bought, like a rivet or an engine. And that you could completely define all these assemblies and where they went in an airplane in a computer program that was of appreciable complexity, but not something that couldn't be handled by ordinary computers and ordinary programming methods. And so that you could have the full instructions for building this and then testing various aspects of it in a computer. And by his estimation, this was about the same complexity as a yeast cell, about 100,000 proteins in a yeast cell that act as a working parts. And so he felt that the complexity of a single simple fungal cell was about the equivalent of a 777 and something that we could encompass in a set of instructions by methods that already existed. I had to point out to him that there's a couple of differences. One is, that is to say, as I put it to him, you know, being me, I said, John, you know, that's true so long as your 777 is 1 micron wide, can find its own fuel, and can reproduce itself. And so we confront a problem of complexity. So what I want to talk about is an approach to that, a very beginning of an approach to that. I'm going to do it with some specific examples from plant biology, which is going to take a little bit of introduction for the people in the audience who are not botanists, and I gather there may be one or two. And I'm going to rely heavily on work that's been done by some people in the audience in a collaboration with Eric Mjolnes, with Henrik Jansson and Pavel Krupinski, who did some of the stuff I'm going to talk about, and Oreske Balduad, if he's here. I've never met him yet, but he's a collaborator. We published some of this stuff together. And others who aren't here, like Marcus Heisler and Olivier Hamant and Jan Tross, and the list goes on and on. Okay, so here's the idea. How do we get from genome to phenotype, which is a word that geneticists use to describe what the characteristics of a whole organism are? And so I want to talk about one specific example, just a tiny piece of development in a very simple plant. And it's still quite complex, and I'll talk about a couple of characteristics of it to try and give an idea of the steps that I think we all have to go through to develop this new science whereby we can really create predictive and specific models for what's going on in development, and models of a sort that in the end can all be added together so that the collection of models can work together and describe the whole organism, which is something that developmental biologists have never gotten anywhere near. They all study one little process and get as far as they can with it to where their intuition runs out, and they go to another little process. And the intuition runs out at about 3 to 5 genes. Unless there's feedback, then it runs out at about 2 genes, as I'll point out. And so what we need to do to understand tissues, morphogenesis, and development is, first of all, I'll talk a little bit about image analysis, because there are new ways of gathering developmental information that give us a lot more information. And Manjanath and his lab, who are in back there, have been a big help on all this, and they're the professionals. If you have any image analysis questions, ask Manjanath or Alex Cunha over here. And then we need computational models, and I'll talk about a computational model of some chemical signaling between cells that Henrik worked out. And then physical models, and I'll point out why we need the physical models, and Henrik's also, and Pavel are much involved in this. And then connection between physical and chemical models and the substrate, if I get to that, and then connection between the chemical and the physical models. And all told, what we'll try and do is put together a very simple model, computational model, so there's a mathematical basis, in which the parameters and the equations are as much as possible things that cells can know. We don't have flux squared of a hormone, we have concentration of a hormone. We have things that cells can know in here as much as possible. And as much as possible, as Eric Kramer will emphasize over and over again, think parameters that we can get out of the literature. We don't make up the diffusion rate of this stuff, we look it up. And so as much as possible, the models are linked to the reality of the organism so that we can do experiments, change the parameters, and see if the models are properly predictive. All right, here's the introduction of the plant. There was some discussion here yesterday about model systems and plants, and some people were asking me about plants, so I brought a few slides to introduce this particular plant that I'll be talking about, although knowing a bunch about the plant isn't especially relevant to what else I'm going to talk about. This is Arabidopsis thaliana, one that's just beginning to flower, and so it's smaller than it ordinarily is. In a normally sized hand, it's a small plant. And the reason biologists use this as one of the plants that are used in the laboratory is because it is small, and it has a lot of flowers, so it has a lot of seeds, and therefore very easy to do genetics with. And it grows quickly. So here's a young Arabidopsis plant just when it's beginning to make its flowers. The seed germinates, that's the dirt, there's some roots, and it makes roots, and then it makes cotyledons, it's a dicot. Then there's a spiral pattern of leaves that are made called the rosette. And then when it's time to flower, which the plant assesses by looking at some parameters of its environment, it then starts to elongate a stem very rapidly, but there's still leaves for a while, and then there are flowers instead of leaves. So that's the life cycle of the plant. Here's what it looks like if you're growing a bunch of them in the lab, and each of these are a few centimeters across, so you can grow very large numbers of the plants in the laboratory. And if you're willing to look at them when they're young seedlings, you can grow them in petri dishes. And you can grow a lot more than this if you want. So this is something I just pulled out of the literature, where somebody irradiated the heck out of a mutant in a wild-type plant, and the mutant's more sensitive to the radiation. Plants are really radiation sensitive. So 100 gray, you know, a plant can take that. People. All right, here's the part of the plant I'll be talking about. So here's again our Arabidopsis plant with a leaf rosette and a shoot and then a bunch of flowers at the top. And all of this stuff, the leaves, the stem, and the flowers, are made by a collection of stem cells that are first set aside in the seed during embryogenesis that are called the shoot apical meristem. And this collection of cells persists through the growth of the plant at the tip of a shoot. And this is true not just for Rhabdopsis, but for pretty much any plant. A giant sequoia does the same thing, just for longer. And so that you have this collection of cells, and it's a few hundred cells that you can see here at the time when the plant is flowering. And they pour out behind them, as these cells in the stem cell population divide, they pour out behind them cells that become parts of the stem. And as they pour out more and more of those, the shoot apical meristem gets lifted up like a frozen fountain. And so it's always at the end of each shoot in a plant. If you go outside, each shoot in a plant here is going to have a shoot apical meristem on the end of it, unless it's dead. And then on the flanks of the shoot apical meristem, there are collections of cells that begin to divide rapidly that constitute the primordia of leaves during the vegetative growth of the plant, and then of flowers during the reproductive growth of the plant. And so again, step outside when we're done and take a look, and you'll see around each stem there are a bunch of leaves, and then if the plant is flowering around the stem with the leaves behind it, there are a bunch of flowers. Most shoots after they flower don't revert to vegetative again, but if you find some callistemons outside, they do. And so there'll be flowers, then leaves, then flowers, then leaves, and you can see where last year's flowers were. And these shoot apical meristems continue to grow indeterminately until the shoot terminates its growth. And there are various ways that the shoot can terminate its growth. One property of these shoot apical meristems is that each time a leaf is made on the flanks of the shoot apical meristem, a new shoot apical meristem forms at the base of the leaf, facing in towards the stem. And then that behaves just like the original shoot apical meristem. And so you can start with an acorn and end up with an oak tree, where at the end of every one of those shoots, there's a shoot apical meristem. Somewhere in there, if it's still alive, is a primary shoot apical meristem. And then there are secondaries and tertiary and quaternary and on until you get this entire, I guess, fractal pattern of the tree, though I hesitate to say anything like that in front of an audience of physicists, because I have no idea what it means. So the shoot apical meristem, and it's the same picture, looks like this. You can see individual cells here. To give a scale, each of these cells is about 5 microns in diameter. There are a few hundred cells in the meristem, which is defined as the cells above the last primordium that are being made. And it's quite a complicated beast. I don't want to get into all the things that are going on in here, but these cells are not homogeneous. There are lots of different domains, small domains, a few handful of cells, of gene expression by which you can differentiate these cells from each other. And the cells that express different sets of genes behave differently from each other. I'm only going to talk about a few of those cells. I don't want to get into the whole business, but it's interesting. And maybe later in the course we can get more and more into detail into how we can fully model this collection of just a few hundred cells, so 10 to the 12th fewer cells than there are in a human body. And furthermore, these cells are simplified compared to animal cells. That is to say, each cell is just as complicated as a human cell, probably. But the cells do some things that their behavior is simpler than that of animal cells. For example, they never get up and move. Animal cells migrate. Plant cells stay fixed. Each of these cells is surrounded by a cellulose wall, cardboard wall or wood wall, and they're under a lot of turgor pressure. So each cell is under up to 10 atmospheres of pressure pushing out against this wall. And then every pair of cells shares a wall, and they're fixed to the wall, and so that they never slide with respect to each other. They don't get up and migrate, and they don't even slide. And so that as each one of these cells expands, it pushes on its neighbors, and then it divides, and other cells divide. And there has to be some coordination of the division here, otherwise you get lumps rather than a uniform, constant-looking meristem. And also the meristem retains its number of cells through the life of the plant from reasonably early on until the end of the shoot. And so there's some general control of the amount of cell division in the meristem balanced against the departure of cells to make stem, leaves, and flowers. And these are things that I probably won't get back to, but we know a lot about. Now, the problem I want to talk to, well, Wait, before I do that, let me introduce them the method by which we study the meristem. And we've developed in my lab, and other labs have developed too over the past 4 or 5 years, 5 years, I guess, is some live imaging methods whereby we can actually watch what's happening while the meristem grows, and we can see a series of different things at the same time. So this is a shoot apical meristem viewed from the top. The plasma membranes of the cells are green because it's a transgenic plant. We've put a fluorescent protein that inserts into the plasma membrane. Then we've taken confocal microscope, laser scanning microscope pictures in a series of optical sections, reconstructed them into a 3D image, then taken those 3D images and made it into a 4D movie by aligning 3D images every 2.5 hours. And this is looping through 65 hours, so about 3 days worth. And you can see the cells dividing, expanding, and then dividing. There's only one cell that doesn't divide in the course of the movie. And this is the shoot apical meristem, and then surrounding it are the primordia of flowers which are forming here. And those cells divide with an average division time of 12 to 18 hours. These ones in the middle, it's 48 to 96 hours before these will divide. So since these are dividing faster, you can see that the primordia grow out. There's some things to say about how that margin is formed, and I don't know if I'll get to it, but it's not passive. There's some real active processes there. But you get these primordia forming one after the other that are the flowers of the plant. And so by using these live imaging methods, we can access a lot of information by eye, and we're trying very hard to train our computers to pull some of this information out for us, and it's not so simple as it turns out. As I said for the first 2 years of this stuff, well, I can see it. Why can't my computer see it? I'm beginning to understand. I still don't understand why, but I'm beginning to understand that it can't or doesn't. And this is where Manjanath and Cunha and these guys come in, because they're geniuses at this stuff. And the degree to which we can extract information in an automated fashion from these meristems, it derives from the work that they've been doing. Now, the sort of things that you can do once you have a live image like this that you couldn't do before you had them, and these live images, again, emphasize the complexity of the system and the need, therefore, to take some new types of approaches to it, are you can do a clonal analysis. Here's an example. You just start at the end of the movie, and this was done by hand. You put a little dot, forget the colors for a second, you just put any kind of a dot on each cell in the primordium of a single flower, and then you run the movie backwards until you see that, and every time a cell divides, well, you're looking at it backwards, so it looks like the cells are fusing. And the number of cells decreases step after step after step until you can get back to a point where these four cells will give rise to all of the epidermal cells of that particular flower primordium. Then you color them differently and run it forward again following the divisions, and you can say that that orange cell then gave rise to that patch of orange cells, and that yellow one to that patch of yellow cells. And that gives you an enormous amount of information about the planes and amounts of cell division in different parts of the meristem, which is very informative about overall morphogenesis and about the sorts of instructions that the cells are responding to. And it gives you a very sensitive way to look at the results of experimental interventions of different sorts, like changing the activity of some particular gene. And so that you can do a clonal analysis like this, which before you couldn't do. You can even, as Eric and the guys in his lab did, extract the nuclear positions in an automated way, create imaginary nuclei in between every nucleus after a division so that these are really fiducial points after a point and not nuclei, follow their movement as the meristem grows, and use that to get equations of growth and very exact parameters of cell expansion and movement of cells. And from that, you can create heat maps of growth. And which you can see in this, each of these rectangles represents a principal component analysis of the movement. So the principal direction is in the long axis, and the colors are how much the cells are growing. And what you can see here in this meristem is the rapid growth of the floral primordia, but even the very earliest stages in which the floral primordia are being established in the meristem, right when there are just 3 or 4 cells, and they start to expand faster than their neighbors as a result of having been specified as floral cells, which changes their expansion and their division behavior. So you can really track that back in detail. You can also use reporter genes. These are just some triply marked meristems that Marcus Heisler made in my lab, where the red fluorescent proteins, actually yellow fluorescent proteins, hooked to a gene called Revoluta, which is expressed in the shoot apical meristem as one of the first things activated in the new floral primordia, a gene that specifies The backside of the primordia is labeled with a green fluorescent protein called Kanadi, and it's a nuclear protein, you can see that. And then a plasma membrane protein that's involved in moving a hormone auxin, the PIN1 protein, is labeled in blue in this triply labeled thing, so you can see where the concentration of this auxin-related protein is highest, which is in the floral primordia, goes over a region that's specified by Kanadi and where Revoluta gets to be activated at a certain point. And so you can follow the activation of individual genes in a cellular and a subcellular level at the same time as you're making these live images. So again, you can get really a lot of information. Here's another movie just because I love them. This is a sepal growing in a flower done by Adrienne Roeder in my lab, and she's measured, she's circled all the pairs of cells when they divide and then colored the clones in. So you can watch this yellow clone, for example, form a little group of cells as a sepal develops. So this is applicable not only to shoot apical meristems, but to other parts of the plant as well. Now the problem I want to talk about, I want to cut down from all the many things this meristem is doing. It's making stem cells, making leaves, it's making flowers. The flowers themselves are very complicated. When they form, they do a whole lot of different stuff. And at this point, I should say, speak up. It's supposed to be a discussion, not a lecture. So if anything comes up, anything comes to mind, no joke, let me know, we'll do it. I want to talk about just one thing. It's a really simple and abstracted thing from the shoot apical meristem, which is the pattern in which the leaves and flowers get made around the meristem, which is called the phyllotactic pattern. And there are various different phyllotactic patterns that plants have, but Arabidopsis and most other plants have a spiral phyllotaxis, which is shown here with a vegetative shoot apical meristem, that is when it's making leaves, and these are the early leaf primordia. So that from oldest to youngest, these are numbered. There's the first, and there's the next younger, 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 younger. It's a very regular pattern, where each of these primordia is about 120 to 140 degrees around from the other one. The botany textbooks say 137.5 degrees, but that obviously did not come from a measurement because there are about 20 cells around the meristem when the things first appear, and so it's plus or minus 18 degrees no matter what you do. The flowers come out in the same pattern, so here's older to younger, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and you can see 8 there, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, and you can even predict where the next one will come out even before anything happens. So it's quite a regular spiral pattern, and it's this pattern that once the plants grow up, if these primordia, the products of these primordia get packed together, then you see these very regular looking things like sunflowers or pineapples or pine cones and things. And those are all examples of spiral phyllotaxis with some packing afterwards so that your eye starts to pick out these regular curves in it, which they won't if the stem is really long. But the real pattern is the generative spiral with this, you know, 137.5 plus or minus 20 degrees. Forming around the meristem. One thing you should notice here too, which may come up later, is that the meristem is about the same size here early in the life of the plant and here late. So although all these cells are leaving the meristem to become the leaves and flowers and pouring out behind to make the stem, the overall number of divisions equals the number of cells that departs. Yeah? Yes, please. Oh, well, you see one's clockwise and one's counterclockwise, if you notice. No. In Arabidopsis, it's random. So if you look at any individual plant or any individual shoot, it'll be either clockwise or counterclockwise persistently. But the other shoots are pretty much random also. So there's no direction in this particular plant. Now, somebody may ask if it's the Coriolis effect and if it's the same in the southern hemisphere. We actually really did do this. David Smythe took these seeds to Melbourne and grew them and counted also, and it's also random in Australia, just in case anybody was going to ask. There are other plants that, you know, may have some directionality to them. There's some funny things. If you look at palm trees and islands, usually they're predominantly one way on the north side and the other way on the south side. Nobody really understands it. But these guys are random. We counted thousands of them. It's a good question. I don't know. Some Greek word. We'll Google it at the end of the talk. There's a Y in it, so it must be Greek. That's all I can say. Oh, arrangement. Okay, phyllo is leaf for sure. Arrangement. Okay, got it. Thank you. Great, we have scholars in the audience. And so, and this is the spiral phyllotactic pattern. So I want to talk about the origin of that pattern. Now, it requires a slight diversion into a piece of plant chemistry, which goes like this. It's long been known, and I'll show you a little bit of evidence for this, that the position where each new leaf or flower appears is specified, is caused by a high concentration of a plant hormone called auxin, which chemically is mostly indole-3 acetic acid related to the amino acid tryptophan. It has indole in it. And indole acetic acid, or auxin, this hormone whose high concentration at each of these positions, 100 and something degrees apart, creates the spiral phyllotactic pattern, has a private circulatory system that works like this. Indole acetic acid is a weak acid and has a pK of around 5.5. Plant cells are at about neutral pH in their cytoplasm, pH of 7. But outside the cells, it are about pH 5.5. As the result of the action of a series of ATP-burning proton transport proteins that take protons from the cytoplasm and put them out into the cell wall. So the cell wall is at lower pH in the cytoplasm as the result of an energetic function of these proton ATPases that are found in the plasma membranes. So when auxin is inside a cell, it's dissociated from its proton and it's charged, and it won't go through the membrane. It's stuck. It's acid-trapped. When it's outside the cell, it's about its pK, so it's half associated with a proton, it's uncharged, and uncharged molecules will go through a plasma membrane. And so the auxin can get into a cell reasonably freely, but once it's in, it can't get back out. The way it gets out is it's directed outward by a specific protein, which is an auxin efflux carrier, an auxin channel, that lets the auxin out of the cell. And that's found in the plasma membranes. And it's found asymmetrically distributed in the plasma membranes. And this is going to be at the heart of the model we're getting to. So that if you have a row of cells like this, and the efflux carrier protein is found only on the bottom of each cell, you'll establish a net auxin flux downward in all the cells. And Mitchison worked this out with a set of ordinary differential equations in about 1971, what a line of cells will do and how fast it can transport auxin. Also worked out by Mary Helen Goldsmith and her collaborators at about that same time. And so we have this special acid trapping mechanism, a protein that lets this acid, indole acetic acid, back out. Whoa, we've gone crazy here. Okay, so previous work has shown, I don't want to get into it, but if you take auxin paste and you put it on a plant meristem at a particular place, it'll induce a new leaf or a flower. This was done in the 1930s. The auxin was in a little bit of lanolin, and you just dip it on a big meristem, and you get a new leaf. When auxin transport is blocked, that is, in mutants, now the protein in the shoot apical meristem that is the auxin efflux carrier protein is called PIN1, so named by Kiyotaka Okada, who first found a mutation, pin-formed one, that I'll show you in a second, which lacks the function of this and therefore doesn't have any primordia of flowers around the meristem and doesn't transport auxin in the inflorescence meristem. So PIN1 mutants, where the auxin's not allowed out of the cells, or in plants where you treat with chemicals that block auxin transport, like naphthol, thalamic acid, the lateral organs don't initiate. And so the transport is causal in the formation of new leaves or flowers. The first what appears? The first leaf or flower? Leaves and flowers are called lateral organs. That's just a word for leaf. Yeah, the meristem, huh? Right, you don't get any leaves or you don't get any flowers. That's right. No, it's not the lateral meristems that you lose. Actually, because there's other PIN genes that are active in the vegetative meristem, you get leaves in PIN1 plants. You don't get any flowers, though. I'll show a picture. Yeah.
So what was auxin and
plant synthesizes it.
So
how does it get to the meristem in the first place?
Yeah. So usually, basically, it's like transport along the surface.
That's right.
It's happening in the bulk, but it's always, the
Yeah, it comes up the sides probably in some way. It's not fully defined, but it looks like some of it comes up the sides and into the meristem from lower down in the plant. But also a good bit of it is synthesized in the meristem. It diffuses up to the surface layer where it's pulled in by an auxin influx protein, which I was trying not to talk about. And then it stays there because there's a high amount of this influx protein in the surface layer.
So it's pulled into the surface layer, into the outer layer.
From where it's synthesized down below.
So
right.
From the inside the stem. Right? So
yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's transported in a little bit more complicated way than a fountain. We'll get to that. Yeah. Pretty much, as far as we know. We haven't really tried to parse it. But what happens when you get the auxin there, when the auxin goes to a high concentration, is the auxin acts by increasing the degradation of a transcriptional inhibitor. So it allows the transcription of a bunch of auxin-induced genes and the repression of some genes. Some of the transcriptional regulators are repressors. And so you get an immediate change in the genetic state of the cells when the auxin passes a certain concentration. I don't know. I mean, we know what the mechanism of perception is. It's not cooperative, is it, Ruth? So is there a threshold? It could be graded. But there's probably some set of genes that when they kick off, it becomes irreversible. And I could go, we know a lot about the genes that get activated, but that's not what I'm going to talk about. Yeah,
so the
fair.
Plants tend to grow towards the light, right?
Yeah, that's auxin too.
So is there some...
It's different.
So how does it tend to go?
That's
light?
Pin 3, probably. It's I'm not sure about the light, but gravity is pin 3. Yeah, in this case, it's a blue light receptor, right? It's which one? It's not the UV. It's the not MPH, the phototropin. So, is a blue light receptor that perceives the light and turns that into a direction of auxin transport. So related to this, gravity too. I mean, an auxin makes a cell expand. Some cells make some cells not expand. Depends if it's a root or shoot cell, but it affects the growth of the cells. And the shoot here, more auxin means the cells expand more, which actually is what we saw in that heat map. And the auxin gets high where a new flower is going to be, the cell starts to expand, and so we saw movement of the nuclei away from each other, even before they begin to divide. And the way the light thing works is the auxin gets directed to the dark side by movement of pin proteins, and so it makes the thing bend over towards the light. In gravity, when it's a shoot, it gets directed to the downside. But that's different pins. There are 8 pin proteins in the Arabidopsis genome, and pin 1 is the one I'm talking about. Pin 3 is the gravity one. I'm not sure which one's the light one. Which one's light? Is that pin 3 too? Do you remember? Yeah. But those are auxin phenomena. And then if you block the transport, but add a drop of auxin back, you can rescue organ initiation. So you're not, with these chemicals that block transport, you're not blocking the initiation of the organ, you're just blocking the ability of the auxin to get to a high enough concentration via transport to induce the gene activities that create the new organ. So here's a pin mutant just to show it. That's what the shoot apex looks like in a pin mutant, and there aren't any primordia forming. If you put a big glob of auxin on that, it makes a non-localized primordium that grows out as a ring. If you put a little dot, you get a little flower coming out, but a big glob. And so that you see that there's this whole region surrounding the middle of the meristem that's capable of creating these primordia, and will if it gets enough auxin. This turns into a messy piece of junk if you let it go for a few days. Now, if we actually look at the genes that are activated upon adding auxin to a PIN1 mutant shoot apex like this, we can do some microarray treatments, and we get all these expression profiles of the genes. And within about half an hour, there are a bunch of genes whose activity jumps up, which are the ones that are activated at the very earliest stage of flower development. And one of them turns out to be PIN1 itself, the auxin efflux carrier. So we already have a problem, at least for a biologist. I don't think it's a problem for a physicist, but it's a problem for a biologist, which is, okay, I'm a cell in the shoot apical meristem, and I have a lot of auxin in me. The first thing this auxin causes me to do is to make more auxin efflux carrier, and so I spit all my auxin out. Or I'm a cell in the shoot apical meristem, I don't have much auxin in me, so I don't have very much efflux carrier in me. So whatever auxin I'm synthesizing or that I'm importing accumulates. And so if I'm a cell with a lot of auxin, I'm actually a cell with a little bit of auxin. If I'm a cell with a little bit of auxin, I actually have a lot of auxin. So I'm already puzzled because there's feedback in the system. And so we already don't know what's going on without a differential equation. This also gives us an opportunity, because if we label the cells in the shoot apical meristem with PIN1 attached to a fluorescent protein and do our live imaging, we can see two things. We can see the auxin concentration in each cell from how bright the fluorescence is, because the gene's induced by auxin. And we can also see which direction the auxin is being sent, because we can see which side of the cell the PIN1 is on. So this live imaging enables us to, so here's a different auxin reporter showing that the place where the PIN1, which is labeling the membranes here, is brightest is also where auxin-induced genes, shown in red, are induced in nuclei, just as you'd expect. So you can use PIN1 as an auxin reporter. And here's a movie Marcus Heisler did showing the PIN1 over time. And you can see these are the new primordia. There's one there that's just starting. See, it gets brighter as the auxin concentration arises. And then these are the other primordia. But note, when they get older, they empty out of auxin, and the PIN1 goes back down again. So you have a process where auxin goes high. These things form early flower primordia, and then when the primordia get a little older, the auxin comes back out again. So it's much livelier than you would imagine from looking at dead and immunologically stained tissue, which is what people had looked at before this. If you enlarge it, you can see the direction in which the auxin is being pumped from these cells or allowed out of the cells. The red is just the plasma membrane stain, and the green is the auxin transporter PIN1 stain. So to any interface, if green is on this side and you see more red on that side, then the auxin is going from here to here. And you can go over the entire meristem and work out the direction in which the auxin is being moved in all these cells. And the conclusion from this exercise is that generally the auxin is moving from areas where there's low auxin concentration toward areas where there's high auxin concentration. And so the channels line up on the side of a cell where the neighboring cell has higher auxin concentration. And as a result, they're really countering the diffusion of the auxin. We'll get to that. That's a big question. And I'll give you some hypotheses, but I can't give you an answer. But I'll show you how these models are really helping us frame the hypotheses. Yeah? There'll be what inside? No, actually all this is just happening in the surface layer of cells. Once these get to a little bit bigger primordia, then the PIN1 starts to get activated farther down. It gets activated at the bottom of the first layer of cells first, then at the bottom of cells just underneath those, and then the auxin starts to flow in, whereby it creates the vasculature that leads up to the flower. But that's much later than what I'm showing. They fill up and then they empty back out, pretty much empty back out before that happens. The auxin? No, it doesn't have to. You can cut the meristem off, put it in a petri dish so there's no auxin coming from below, and this keeps going. So a lot of it's getting synthesized in various places here. In fact, auxin is synthesized in the primordia, but it's this transport mechanism that localizes it. It doesn't have to come from below. It does, some of it does come from below, but it doesn't have to. And so here's a model for what's going on based on our observations. First of all, the auxin efflux carrier moves auxin. We didn't figure that out. And its gene is auxin-induced, so the rate of transport from a cell depends on the auxin level in the cell. Turns out, as Henrik will tell you, this isn't very important in the end, but it is true. Secondly, the local high auxin concentration causes new primordia, as shown by Snow and everybody else. And it gets high locally by transport and by diffusion. And third, the auxin efflux carrier is polarized in the cells, and it points towards neighboring cells with the highest auxin concentration. So those are the things I've just gone through. So is this enough to create phyllotaxis, a spiral pattern, is the question. And this is where I, as a biologist, was on the rocks. I have no idea. I've been in this business long enough to be brash enough to just assert that it does, but But nobody believes that. And so this is where we need computational morphodynamics. We need somebody to come in and translate a model like this into something that's in the language of the plant, not in English, and then try it out. And so here's what Henrik did. And these are those same three statements, exactly. Rate of change of the pin 1 concentration in cell I with time. There's some function of creation of pin 1, which is proportional to auxin concentration, minus degradation, which is first order in pin 1, of course. The rate of change of auxin concentration in cell I with time, some production constant, minus degradation, or conjugation is one way this stuff becomes inactive, minus the active transport into all the surrounding cells, plus diffusion from all the surrounding cells. So there is some diffusion. And the direction, which are points, is we just made it linearly proportional to the auxin concentration in the surrounding cells. Okay, now we've translated that biologist model into a model that most of the people in this audience understand better, and certainly a plant understands better. And then if you do as Henrik did, is you make simply a hexagonal array of round cells in a single sheet. Oh, I keep touching this button and giving away my surprises. And then you add a new cell right in the middle each cycle, and each of these cells is populated with those three equations, and when the auxin concentration goes high, it gets red, and you just keep it running, you get the spiral pattern out. What Henrik actually does is he has the auxin peak move out one bump each time. It's not really adding one new cell in the middle each time. Yeah. Yeah. But there's a point where it comes back out, and I'll get to that. It gets lower again also. Pretty much, right? Ask Henrik. It's pretty much the diffusion coefficient. And so, yes, this model is sufficient to create a spiral phyllotactic pattern. There's more going on, and we'll get to, there's a lot more going on, but it's not a bad start. Yeah. I don't even know what that means. We just move them out one. It ends there because that's how many dots they had the patients to draw. Which is actually true, because if you look at the response to auxin in the real meristem, it's less responsive in the center. Yeah. It's not entirely known. Yeah. Eric knows. Uh-huh. There are at least four pathways. Four, I think. Yeah.
The genes haven't been completely characterized, but it seems like they're making, it's not clear, no cell in our house is completely capable of making auxin. So every cell may have some capacity for something, whether it's actually making it or not isn't clear yet. And similarly, the genes involved in the degradation of auxin, I mean, auxin can be stored in a conjugation, right? And
There's each cycle when all these equations are numerically solved in each cell, there's one new cell that's put into the middle. It's just not shown as a beautiful movie. It's actually, what it is that the Oxen Peak has moved out one cell diameter each time. Now, the way this got, somebody's going to ask about the origin of this pattern. I think Henrik just ran it on his laptop till rounding error created an inhomogeneity in Oxen, and then it locks into this pattern with these parameters. Now, that's not how a plant does it. That's another story, how a plant does it. But it's at least maintenance of the pattern. Yeah? Yeah. Yeah, you mean my previous slide showing the oxen coming back out of a primordium and that sort of stuff. That's next. Oh, the previous slide with the equations. No, I wasn't. This.
So you have a Cij.
Yeah. That's the whole topic of what I'm going to talk about for the rest of the time. Yeah, we're going to have a knockdown drag out here between Eric and Henrik because they're working on, we just don't know yet. All right, so this is a simplification, right? I pointed out that you have these primordia that are high in auxin, and here we're seeing pin 1 in the plasma membrane as a proxy for auxin concentration. And then after a while, there's a reversal so that the cells surrounding the primordium start to direct their auxin back into the meristem and away from the primordium. And there's a wave of this that moves into the primordium and empties the primordium of much of its auxin until the primordium is empty. And so how does that happen? And if you make a more realistic substrate for the model, as Henrik has done, where now the cells are held together by springs, they have 5, 6, or 7 neighbors in the same proportions that a real meristem does, and you have them dividing more or less at random, and you run these equations in here, you get that exact phenomenon occurring, which is what's really happening there, if you want to think about it intuitively, is this, that as you have the auxin build up in a primordium like this one or this one, it goes for a while, eventually, because of transport, the region behind here is depleted in auxin. And the region even farther back from that, therefore, has higher auxin here than here. And as a result, the pin 1 moves towards the higher auxin neighbors and starts to direct the auxin backwards. And that wave sweeps into the primordium and empties it. And in fact, it's the exact auxin that made these two primordia, these two primordia, that moves back to make the next primordium. And that's where the pattern comes from. New flower. Yeah. So there's a flower forming, there's one, and there's the next one. It's actually that auxin from these two that goes back and makes that one. So the position of this one really depends on where those two were. And that's been experimentally known since the 1960s. You take a razor blade and cut one of these guys off, the next flower goes into a different place. But if you take the third one back and cut it off, then nothing happens. It's the last two that really have the most influence. And it's for this reason. Yeah. It either starts one way or the other, and it persists because it's the last two primordia that make the next one go. So it explains the maintenance of the pattern. It's random, I think, before that. How the things that are non-random do it is beyond me. But Arabidopsis, it's random. All right, so the distribution of auxins involved in patterning pin 1 and can influence pin polarity. Pin polarity responds to signals generated by neighboring cells. Support a proposed model. This is a new class of developmental model, but I won't get into this. That is, the developmental pattern formation is an important field in plant and animal biology. And up until this, there are only two types of models by which cells interacted with each other to create pattern. There's reaction diffusion models, a la Turing, where some inhibitor diffuse, activator and inhibitor diffuse at different rates and create stripes of some sort. And they can be more complicated than that, or a mutual inhibition model where one cell randomly starts to activate something which represses a process in the neighboring cell, and the neighboring cell activates the process in the cell next to it, and so you get a sort of winner-take-all thing, and that's how Drosophila bristles are made, for example. The big bristles get spaced out that way, or the trichomes on a plant leaf. But this is a different class. It's a regulated transport model. So far, not observed in anything but oxen. I'm sure the animal guys will discover it eventually. You might ask then, as Boris has been asking, is it, first of all, is it really true that if you have a high oxygen concentration, it makes the pin 1 go to the other side of a cell that's adjacent to where the concentration side? So you can take an apex like this one and put a drop of oxygen in lanolin right there, and sure enough, within a couple of hours, the pin 1 of all the cells around that aims toward the high oxygen concentration, so you can watch it happen. So yeah, it is true, but it's mysterious because the mechanisms that we know of auxin perception don't allow for any directionality, simply the degradation of a transcription factor that auxin induces. And so you either have to postulate some new way of sensing auxin or some different sort of process other than simple perception of the auxin gradient that these cells are doing to know that their neighbors have a high auxin concentration and therefore they should export their auxin toward them. And so the question then arises, how does a cell directionally detect the auxin concentration of its neighbors? Is auxin itself a signal? Well, I don't know. Eric and I were arguing about that last night. I don't think so. He thinks it might be.
Not between cells.
Yeah, I don't think the gradient would be sufficiently steep between cells. And we don't know of any mechanism by which it could be that. We can block transport, and the pin 1 still moves when we add auxin. We can have a lot of auxin that diffuses freely and doesn't seem to block the process, though maybe, as Eric pointed out, there's some special auxin perception mechanism that doesn't get the auxin analogs that we've used. Yeah.
So can pin 1 itself be a sensor?
Could be. Could be part of one. Oh, yeah. Yeah, there are mutants where the pin 1 doesn't polarize easily. It barely polarizes. They're not mutants of pin 1. They're mutants of associated proteins that are important for the relocalization. One is called pinoid, which is a kinase that phosphorylates the pin 1, and the phosphorylated pin 1 seems to move much more readily. So we do have some things to work with. In fact, that last meristem that I showed was a pinoid one, so that you could actually see the movement without having to look at the phyllotaxis happening, because the pinoid don't have any flowers.
Yeah. Why are you dismissing the idea of detecting flux? I mean, these are all fairly iffy.
Well, I don't know how a cell could detect flux. That's maybe a sidebar discussion. A cell can detect concentration, but how does it detect flux? How does a pin know how much auxin it's let out? Just a protein. Does it have a counter somewhere? Right. This is a concentration-based model, not a flux-based model. Yeah, this one is, yeah. The flux-based models, that's Przinkiewicz, you guys, that's flux squared and stuff like that. Bogus.
Yeah.
Because no one's ever thought of a plausible mechanism by which a cell could measure it. I've asked Premek that, and he said, well, look, an ammeter can measure a flux of electrons. Why can't a cell measure a flux of auxin? But the electrons are charged and going at the speed of light, and so that gives you certain other things you can do. Yeah. No, that's a measurement of the concentration in the cell. Not flux, concentration. And out. There are also transporters, but it's largely passive. Can't be passive. Yeah. Yes. They're just channels, really. No, they're just channels, and they're not. No, they're not pumping against. No, they're not active pumps. They're just channels. The energy comes from the proton ATPases and the pH difference, and so that with the auxin, charged auxin is only inside the cell, right? Mostly, So the concentration of that is always higher because of the pH gradient. No.
And I think I used to think they were channels, but I asked around, and I think because of the specificity, they are carriers. It's just like they do undergo a conformational change moving out to
the. Oh, yeah, probably.
So you undergo
but they're not using energy to do it.
They're not burning ATP to do it.
Thermal energy, yes. They're not burning ATP. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and you're talking tomorrow morning too. You can bring it up if you want. Yeah.
So is there any more discomfort? Is there any other manifestations there? Is there site scale changes or?
We'll get to that. Yeah, you're predicting what I'm just getting to. I'll get to it. We don't know what it means, but yeah, there are some cytoskeletal changes. You can think of other models. There's some the ones that I have always thought are the most plausible are they're in animal cells, there are these things called efferents, which are proteins that hang out of the cell a reasonably long way. These cells are about 80 nanometers apart, which isn't very far for a protein to span in a pseudapical meristem, about the same distance between animal cells and the animal extracellular matrix. And they're, let's say, in the development of capillaries or veins and things, there are these efferents that hang out of cells, and there are efferent receptors in cells too. And so when a cell makes a bunch of efferents, they hang out, the receptors contact them on the neighboring cells, and that's a signal. And this could work that way, but there's no evidence that it does work that way. But it seems that the most, to the people in my lab at least, the most interesting hypothesis is the following one. Whether it's true or not, I don't know. That's what we're going to get into next, is the modeling, whether it's true or not. And this is where the models have turned out to be the most important for my lab, because although it's easy enough for us to say, yeah, we've got this figured out, the modelers can't get it to work. And so there's something we're not doing right, which is that we know that auxin causes a loosening of the cell wall. And so it causes trigger pressure to push the cells out and make the cells expand. And so a cell that has high auxin concentration is expanding faster than its neighbors. Now remember, we have this whole tissue that's something like a brick wall, and we're adding new bricks in the middle somehow. These cells expand and divide, and they're doing it in some way that's coordinated such that the overall shape of the thing stays about the same, even though they're under an enormous amount of pressure, and they're just as hard, each cell's as hard as a rock, which you know if you ever bit a carrot, that's, you know, it goes crunch and snaps. These cells are hard. And so suppose a cell that has more auxin in it is expanding more rapidly, and the neighboring cells are sensing that strain, or they're being stressed by that enlargement. And somehow the side that's most stressed attracts the pin one, something like that, a real physical mechanism. Could something like that be true? And so I'm going to go through a little bit diversion here to show that plant cells actually do sense stress and the direction of stress. Then we'll come back to the question, still very unanswered, whether auxin could be sensed by a physical and not a chemical mechanism. And you'll see the people who are involved in this in the audience light up and start arguing, because it's a very exciting area, and it's one where modeling is really going to tell us what could possibly be true. So can stress really be sensed directionally by meristem cells? And the answer is yes, it can. And here's an example of a shoot apical meristem stained now not for pin 1, but for microtubules. Each of these cells has a set of microtubules, these long linear polymers found in animal cells too, first discovered in plant cells, wound as a helical array just underneath the plasma membrane called the cortical microtubule array. And each plant cell has one of these, and you can see the direction of the array in each of these cells. Now, what dictates the direction of this array is not something people thought about a whole lot before, although there's some literature we could get into it if you want. But you can see this is what it looks like in the shoot apical meristem. Now, there's one thing to know about these cortical arrays other than that they form, which is that they also serve as tracks for cellulosynthase complexes. So when new parts of a cell wall are made, the new cellulose fibrils are parallel to the cortical microtubules, generally. And therefore, when new cell wall material is made, it reinforces the cells parallel to the cortical microtubule arrays. And so these cells are anisotropic, right? Because they're reinforced in the direction of microtubule arrays. All that we really know that they do is two things in these cells. One is they serve as tracks for the cellulosynthase complexes, and secondly, they predict the direction of the next cell wall that forms, so that the next wall will be parallel to these when they divide. So that they're involved in establishing the plane of division and also in reinforcing the wall with cellulose. And in fact, what happens if you depolymerize them all using arisolin or some other drug, and you let this thing keep growing, and these are some experiments that Jan Tross and his collaborators have done, and Rezky, if he's here, is involved in this, he's supposed to get here today sometime, is that the cells expand but don't divide, and in fact, while they're expanding, they take on the characteristics of a foam. So that depending on how many walls they have concavities or convexities. The angles, three-way angles between the cells are always go to 120 degrees and all these other characteristics of something that's completely isotropic. So the arisolin in the long run is responsible for the anisotropy of the cells, and they're isotropic and just foam-like if you get rid of it. They don't divide, and so they just keep getting bigger and bigger, and it's like a bunch of soap bubbles. But I'm not going to get to that. So we look at these. If, in fact, we look at them in live imaging, and this is a meristem, and that's a big flower primordium next to it, what you see is that the direction of the microtubules is reasonably fixed, say, in this saddle point between the meristem and the flower primordium. But in the top of the meristem, they're quite lively, and they change their direction all the time. So they're very dynamic, and they're always changing the direction. And you can see. I'm not sure, actually, but I think it's probably a series of two-hour steps through about 10 or 15 hours. I'm not sure in this exact movie, but here's a difference at over 20 hours of the same set of cells, and you can see all these directions have changed quite a bit. They change on the time scale of 2 to 4 hours, something like that. Yeah, yeah, remember, they're wound in a helical array. We're looking down on it. Yes, well, because they're wound around a cell, and so when you're looking straight down, the sides that are orthogonal to the array and the top wall look brighter because you're looking down a bunch of microtubules. And so, yeah, so that, you know, they go back and forth between the bright parts. And so it's very lively, and it was noticed by Rezky and others, is that it fits very nicely to a pressure vessel model of something with this shape. So if you have pressure inside some rigid thing, you can calculate the direction of stress. And where the stresses are reasonably isotropic, the microtubules keep changing their direction over time, every couple of hours. And where the stresses are anisotropic, like at these saddle points, where they're strongly across the saddle points, the microtubules are locked up, and they're parallel to the principal direction of stress. So this is an observation that could explain the direction of the microtubules. In fact, you can make a spring model, and this is one of Henrik's models, so ask him, but in which you're looking at the stress in the cell walls, and a real template actually tracing a lot of these cells so that it actually represents what's seen in a real meristem. And the principal directions of stress correspond very well to the direction of the microtubules and things like these saddle points. There's a long discussion about whether it could be perpendicular to strain. We can get back to that, but it isn't. Get to it. I don't know. I do not know how they know that, but they do know. Oh, and the calculation, how does this cell know which way the stress is? I don't know. Just a bunch of springs. Yeah, that was the spring model. And so how do you test something like this biologically? Well, one way is Yves Cuder and the guys in his lab made a little tiny vise, and we just squished the thing to change, you know, this is about 70 microns across, so you have to do it under a microscope, but you can squeeze it. And when you squeeze it before, you see these random arrays of microtubules at the top, and they tend to align. I mean, the cells are getting pushed this way, they're expanding that way, and the direction of stress is parallel now to the microtubule arrays. And if you look at the microtubule arrays, they do two things. They unstable ones tend to become stable when you squeeze the meristem, and there it is getting squished in two different pictures. And there's a strong tendency for them to be parallel to the principal direction of stress. Yeah. Could be. It could be, because they're anisotropic. But
well, I'm just wondering whether...
but generally not, no. Yeah, in here. We can make cases where they're not. The experiment that shows it is one that I haven't talked about. It's an arisolin experiment where you have a cell that's a long linear cell. It's reinforced around like this, and it expands in that direction. So that's the direction of strain. The stress is predominantly this way, so the microtubules are either perpendicular to strain or parallel to stress. And there's a large literature that shows this is the case. You add arisolin, you depolymerize the microtubules, the cell starts to expand this way. The microtubules are gone, of course, but that shows that the maximal stress was in this direction, right? Parallel to the microtubule, so that it's parallel to stress, not perpendicular to strain. Because in this case, the strain is parallel to the stress, right? In that case, the strain is perpendicular to the stress, and it always goes with the stress. Yeah. Yeah, these ones didn't, as you can see, because this is just 6 hours, and the average time between divisions here is several days, but they are still dividing.
So is that reorganizing the microtubules?
Yeah, well, they can reorganize without division, but when the cell does divide, and it divides parallel to however the array was when it divides, afterwards, the two daughter cells can be either which way. They can retain their microtubule position, one can change it, or both can change it. So the division itself doesn't seem to affect the behavior of the microtubules, but the direction of the microtubules does seem to direct the plane of division. And here's one where we continued squeezing. We just let the vise keep squeezing it until they all locked up and they're predominantly parallel to the predicted direction of stress. Here's a movie showing a squeeze so you can actually see these same cells I showed a second ago. You can see them changing. Over 16 hours in this case. And you can actually see the strain of the cells getting a little bit bigger. Now there's another question. Now we're up to where Pavel is. So that what if you make a finite element model, and this is one of Pavel's models of meristem. Well, we can talk about the assumptions that went into this, but there's turgor in these cells. The white lines are the principal direction of stress in the walls. What if you take a laser and you just blow one of these cells away? What happens in a model like this is then you get a circumferential arrangement. The stress is circumferential to the hole where these walls have been weakened. The reason for that, which I haven't said, is that the overall tissue is not only this set of high turgor bricks sitting together, but the epidermal layer of cells is under overall tension, as indicated by experiments 50 years ago where you nick it with a razor and it gaps. So, and this is generally true in plants, that the surface cells are under tension and the cells in the middle are under compression. And so that the hole gets pulled bigger and you get a stress that's principal direction is circumferential to the hole. So what if we do this while we're watching the microtubules? And within a couple of hours, the microtubules realign just like the model would predict. And so the answer is yes, the cells can detect stress. and they can detect the principal direction of stress, and they do something that aligns with the principal direction of stress, which is rearrange and lock up their cortical microtubule arrays. So experimentally, we can show that this is plausible. We don't have any idea how they do it. We can talk, I mean, something must be straining some protein in the cell wall or something. I don't know. We don't know. But they do it, and so we need an explanation. We can't just say, well, it's impossible. They do it. So now we as biologists are jammed up because we have to figure out how they do it. But then this gets us back to the original question. Here's one of Pavel's, one of my favorites, Pavel's movie. Check this out. Actually show the dynamics of an ablation in his two-layer meristem here, where this cell is the one that's getting ablated. And it's losing trigger pressure, and then this wall weakens. That's so cool. Somebody's going to ask, and I was hoping Oreski'd be here by now, because this is something he explained to me, and it was great. Can ask how we know that when we do these ablations, it's not just some wound signal going out that's rearranging the microtubules, but in fact, it's really stress. And the answer is this, that if you blow two holes and there's some gradient of some signal coming out of these things, the gradient will be flat in this cell. But if it's stress, this cell will still be strongly stressed in that direction. So we did a two-hole ablation and the microtubules realign like that. So it's not chemical, it's physical. All right, so now how does a cell directionally detect the auxin concentration of its neighbors? And there's something that I was dishonest about at the beginning of this talk. I told you that we knew that a high concentration of auxin was causal in the formation of a new flower, because you can put a drop of auxin on a meristem and you get a new flower to form. But it's also true that you can put drops of other things and get a new flower to form. And the other things that you can add are things that relax the cell wall, like pectin methyl esterase or expansins, which are enzymes that relax the cell walls. And when you add drops of those, you get a new flower too. And in fact, the literature, right up to this year, where Chris Kuhlmeier published a review calling this a paradox, that auxin could induce a new primordium, but so could cell wall looseners. But remember, auxin is a cell wall loosener. It makes a cell expand. And so it's really not necessarily auxin that's creating the primordium. What if it's things that make cells expand? Well, that's already proven, because we have things that aren't auxin but do make cells expand, and they create a new primordium. So auxin causes cell expansion. And what if cell expansion of a cell somehow makes a neighboring cell direct its PIN1 protein to then direct auxin into the expanding cell and positively feedback on the expansion, and thereby giving the new primordium? So this is the hypothesis. And now we're at the point where we can make some observations to show us this could be true. So what if we actually look at PIN1 instead of microtubules and do an ablation? There's an ablation which changes the local stress pattern, cause the PIN1 to move around. And the answer is yes, we're going to ablate, I think, those three cells. You see the PIN1 is aiming towards them from the surrounding cells. And if we ablate them and we look in 2-hour increments for about 8 hours, you see that the PIN1 moves from towards these ablated cells to away from them. So when we change the stress pattern, we do see PIN1 rearrange, even though, as far as we know, we're not doing anything to the auxin flow, because we're right in the middle of the meristem here where there's not much auxin flow going on. And in any event, this happens if we block auxin flow by adding NPA. Well, it's both. They're under a lot of turgor pressure, and so the thing that makes them expand is the wall relaxes. Otherwise, they wouldn't go anywhere. The turgor pressure is also probably not quite the same in all the cells, so there could be local increases in turgor pressure. They have to balance out pretty fast, because the cells are actually all connected by channels that let water go through. Three. There's a line of three of them. I think it's these three right here. That one, and that one. That's correct. And it starts to within a couple of hours, pretty quick. Yeah, but it's faster in some cells than others.
So there's no notion that the faster growing cells that solve the wall.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, it doesn't have to divide at all, and it'll still keep growing. And you can get differential growth if you differentially weaken the walls. And one of the ways a cell does that is it makes an enzyme called expansin that it exports, which eliminates some of the cross bonds between the cellulose fibrils so they can slip relative to each other. That Dan Cosgrove has worked on at Penn State. And one of the nice pieces of evidence that that's how it works is if you take a piece of filter paper and hang a weight on it, and then you add some expansin to it, it does that. So it can be absolutely dead cellulose, and the enzyme loosens it, and then it tightens back up again. It's quite amazing. And the cells are making those things and exporting them. All right, so what if we look at PIN1 and microtubules together in double label experiments? Well, here's the PIN1, some side of cells, and it always does seem to be almost always in a particular relation to the microtubule array. That is, the wall of the PIN1 is parallel to the microtubule array. So there's a correlation there, too, that has to be explained somehow. So again, some sort of a stress model of localization of PIN1 could do it. The why it goes to this wall and not this one is to be something that's in the model. And here's the MPA experiment I put in for Eric, so that if we ablate a bunch of cells in the middle here and are looking at the microtubules, these are two different experiments, but we're now doing them in the doubly labeled plants. The microtubules align circumferentially to the weakened area, and the PIN1 moves away from it, and these plants are in the presence of MPA, so they're preventing, as far as we know, auxin flux through PIN1. And therefore, it's not flow of auxin that's a signal for either of these things, but something else. The red are the dead cells. So we put a little bit of propidium iodide in the water the plant is in. And when you kill a cell, that can enter the cell, and it makes it fluorescent red. And so it tells you which cell you've killed. And then the green in this slide is microtubules. And in this slide, it's the PIN1. So that's for Eric. So then here's a, could it be that the most stressed wall is the one the PIN1 goes to? This is one of Pavel's pictures. And the answer is, I'm not sure that model is working out, right, guys? There's something we're not getting here. And so in this case, before the model showed us that our preformed hypothesis based on observations was plausible, right? Now we've got another hypothesis. We've got a bunch of observations that seem to support it. But the model at this point, is it showing us that our model's plausible, or is it showing us that we're on the wrong track? And so the model here now becomes critical in our understanding what to do next experimentally. And so we're really in computational morphodynamic territory. We can't do the next experiment until we figure out what model is going to work to tell us what to do the next experiment. So now we're in a new type of developmental biology. And I have a phone conversation with Pavel and Henrik and Marcus and Olivier every Monday morning, and we're trying to see whether we can figure out a model that will actually work in silico, in which case we'll say that our hypothesis is plausible. But right now, I'm not so sure it's plausible because we don't have a model that works in silico, and that's a point for some later discussion. So the conclusion here is that cell polarity and responsibilization is not easily perturbed by inhibition of auxin transport, but it fits the patterns predicted by mechanical models. And so maybe phyllotaxis is likely to involve a mechanical-chemical coupling. All right, what does this mean to me as a developmental biologist? It means now if we want a complete description, even in this very abstracted, simple part of development, just the pattern in which the leaves and flowers come out, the phyllotactic pattern, not the plane of cell division, not the amount of cell division, the size of cell expansion, all these things, we have to understand both chemical transport in mathematical detail, auxin flux, and we also have to understand the stress patterns in the tissue, which means that we have to know some things about the viscoelasticity of the cell walls, and a whole variety of things we haven't thought about ever before. And that there's a feedback between these two, and that if we do the models right, we can pour all the equations together in one big model, and it should perfectly reproduce everything that's going on. And when Alan Newell gets here, he'll show you that he's actually done some stress models that show that stress models can also reproduce a phyllotactic pattern without any auxin, but we know auxin is involved. And so here's a chart Jan Tross, a collaborator, did. Well, if we look at microtubule orientation, we just showed you this, they eventually create anisotropy of the cells due to moving the cellulose synthases. You get anisotropic growth, which affects the shape of the cell, and the mechanics feedback on the microtubule orientation. Turgor gives cell wall expansion, there are things that create cell wall expansion. Auxin, local auxin concentration, is one of them. And then there's this whole auxin transport mechanism that's going on here in the red circle. Do these, are these two circles really the same? And should be fused together and have stress as the key that relates them to each other. Why is it? Because the cellulose fibrils are more are aligned with. No, not just that. They also direct a cellulose synthase, and the and for reasons not really known, the most newly synthesized cellulose determines the isotropy of the cell, the properties of the cell wall, and that's been known since the 30s. Looking at single cell algae, where the cell is reinforced this way with cellulose and it grows that way, even though the stress is maximal this way. Of the cell wall. Yes.
So in a way, in the movies, it's really striking how the growth seems to be like a uniform distribution of
To remember, in the dome of the meristem, the microtubular rays are random too.
And that was the scene, cells are getting water, and then they divide.
Right, right. Maybe we're working. Yeah, I think so.
Reasonably well, right?
I think so. That's right.
Definitely bias, and so the cell and the divisions are anisotropic. But that is quite a different story from actually having an anisotropic growth.
Yeah, but remember, okay.
Growth,
yeah. Yep. Yep.
And that may still be there.
And so it works like this. Okay. Okay. So yeah, that is a little bit of a different story, but it's good. So that if a cell expands, is stressed this way, and it's isotropic, it'll strain that way. If it reinforces this way, the next time it stresses that way, it won't move so far in that direction. It'll have effects in this direction. And so the reinforcement tends to resist the stress, which keeps the tissues together. And so it's a good thing. If it was the other way, you wouldn't understand how it worked. And so maybe that's how the shape gets kept together. And when a cell expands and pushes on its neighbors, it affects their next plane of cell division. And we're now looking at that. We're doing the ablations and then waiting long enough to see the next cell divisions and see if they're really circumferential. And the answer seems to be yes so far. And we're trying to work out rules for cell division and then see if they really match. By taking these microtubule movies, but doing them longer than we've done so far. Remember, these cells only divide once every few days. So we have to extend the time of the movies to really see the correlation of microtubule array with the pattern of division. But yeah, you've got it exactly right. And that the overall growth really seems to depend on these sorts of very local feedbacks. In fact, the lesson you can derive from all of this stuff is that all of these global patterns of shape, and of the position where the primordia are all mediated by cells acting locally. It's quite startling, actually. All they know is what they're doing and what their nearest neighbors are doing, and that's all they seem to need to know to make all this stuff happen. One example to prove what you said is right is if we look at the boundary cells at the saddle point between a primordium and the meristem, where the microtubules are always aligned parallel to the boundary point, those cells divide in a most unusual way. The cells are very long, and they divide the long way. While if you look at, you know, all the 19th century literature, when people look at plant cells dividing in places other than that, they always said that, well, the wall went the shortest direction. But those, they go the longest direction, and that's parallel to the microtubules, which are locked up because of this strong stress and the saddle point, we would say. And so the division really does seem to follow it. So what do we really need in computational morphogenesis? What do I need? I need image analysis, computational models of chemical signals, physical models, including the ones like for just the cells to populate with a chemical model. That's a type of physical model, the substrate of the meristem. Then we have to make that realistic with real stresses and strains in it. That is, the connection between physical and chemical models is we build a substrate that's physical. for the equations to live in. And then we find out that the physical models can't be very simple, and there's some feedback involved in the physical forces as well. So if we can put all this together, we may have explained phyllotaxis as one of the 50 things that a shoot apical meristem does, but that's not bad. You know, we have time. The universe isn't, the sun doesn't explode for another 4 billion years or something, right? So we have time to do this, but we need a method by which to do it. And I think if we can all work out how to do it, we'll revolutionize biology. And it won't just be developmental biology. And it'll revolutionize engineering. Suppose an engineer could build a bunch of little things like cells that have some intrinsic activities, and you throw them into a bag on Mars, so NASA will pay for it, and they make, you know, your rocking chair, a house, or a rocket ship, or whatever you want. Why not? Cells do that. And in fact, they're really self-assembling, these cells. There's not enough instructions in DNA code to build a human. It's an emergent process of interactions between cells with particular properties that make all the complexity of a body. There isn't any reason why we can't do this with engineering. And so once humanity has extinguished itself, there'll still be something left. Be a bunch of machines reproducing and building this. The key here is this took a big set of collaborations, and I want to mention some of the people, and some of them are here. Eric, of course, has been a longtime collaborator with me in all this, the guy who patiently explains to me why we need 30 parameters of things we can't measure. And Henrik has also been just as critical in all this. Rather than patiently explaining it, he just builds the model and says, all right, now what? He knows what. Venu Reddy was a postdoc in my lab. He's a professor at UC Riverside now, who, along with Marcus Heisler, who's at European Molecular Biology Lab in Heidelberg now, worked out the live imaging methods. Adrian did that sepal. I didn't talk about her work, and I didn't talk about Sean's work either. Bruce Shapiro has been involved in this modeling in a lot of different ways, and Vijay, who's going to get here later in the course, wasn't involved in the stuff I talked about, but is involved in some other modeling, just as critical for the meristem. And here's Oreski, whom I've never met and is supposed to be here today sometime, who is involved in this, and Eve, whom I don't have a picture. There's Pavel right there. When I showed Henrik, there is Henrik right there. There's Olivier, who's not going to be here, who did the vise and squeezing experiments, and he works in Jan Trost's unit at ENRA in Lyon, ENS Lyon. And all these people are longtime and close collaborators that we're on Skype with all the time. Or lately, not Skype, Evo. You got to try this thing. It's so much better than Skype. It's so cool. Evo, Google Evo space Caltech. It's something that some Caltech physicists invented for the Large Hadron Collider. And you can look at like five or six people's face instead of just one other, like in Skype. And you can share a whiteboard. You can show screenshots. It's really good. You have to wear headphones, though, because it doesn't suppress the echoes. And after, we should all be on Evo after this. We can keep this course going forever. Okay. All right, so I hope that served as one example of what I think computational morphodynamics is. But of course, it encompasses a lot more. And we're here to figure out what it is. And when we're done, all the grant money's going to come our way. Yeah, Claire?